Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're really getting into something profound, existentialism.
It's a philosophical approach, or maybe a family of approaches, really.
Right, exactly. And it grapples with, well, maybe the biggest question: what does it actually mean to be human? Especially when the world often feels confusing, maybe.
It definitely doesn't shy away from the big, sometimes uncomfortable truths about just existing.
Absolutely. So for this deep dive, we've pulled together a whole range of sources, including a pretty detailed Wikipedia excerpt.
Yeah, quite comprehensive.
Our mission then is to unpack all this, to kind of pull out the key insights, make sense of the core ideas.
And show how this way of thinking has, really seeped into art, literature, how we even see ourselves.
We want you to come away with a good, solid understanding, cutting through some of the, let's say, academic jargon.
Right, to get to the practical power behind these concepts.
So just think about this for a second as we start. Have you ever felt like you're just winging it, making life up as you go along?
Or that feeling of looking at all your choices and just wondering, what's the actual point?
Well, existentialism says that feeling isn't just normal, it's like fundamental. It's part of the deal of being human.
Yeah, it speaks right to that raw, sort of unscripted experience of being alive.
So at its heart, existentialism, as you said, it isn't one single thing.
No, it's more like a family of related views.
And what ties them together?
Well, it's this focus on the individual, right? The struggle to live an authentic life.
Even when existence itself seems, well, absurd or just impossible to fully grasp.
Exactly. That's the core tension.
So terms like existential crisis,
Yeah.
angst, courage, freedom, these aren't just buzzwords.
Not at all. They're really baked into this way of thinking. It's about facing those moments, those feelings directly.
And it seems many of the philosophers involved were quite critical of older traditions, like pure rationalism.
Oh, absolutely. They often felt it was too abstract, too disconnected from, the messy reality of actual human experience.
They wanted philosophy to feel more grounded.
Grounded in life as it's lived, yeah.
Yeah.
Not just logically thought about.
And running through all of this is this key idea, maybe the key virtue, authenticity.
Being true to yourself. But it's deeper than just, like, personal style.
Right. It's about aligning yourself with your own freedom, your responsibility for your choices.
Which brings us to the name itself, existentialism. It's got a bit of a story.
Oh.
Yeah, it was actually coined by a French Catholic philosopher, Gabriel Marcel, around the mid-1940s.
Okay, interesting.
But here's the twist. When Marcel first used it to describe Jean-Paul Sartre, Sartre actually rejected it.
Really? He didn't like the label.
Not at first. But then something changed. In late October 1945, he gave this incredibly famous lecture.
Ah, existentialism is a humanism.
That's the one. And in that lecture, he publicly embraced the term. That event and the book that followed really launched existentialism into the mainstream.
Wow. So Sartre popularized the term he initially rejected.
Pretty much. And ironically, Marcel, the guy who coined it, he later backed away from it himself, preferring to call his own philosophy neo-Socratic.
Huh. It just shows how these labels can be kind of slippery, doesn't it?
Definitely. And that slipperiness is important when you try to define existentialism. It's often called a historical convenience.
Meaning it gets applied backwards in time to thinkers like Kierkegaard.
Exactly. Long before the term existed.
Yeah.
So some scholars tried to keep it narrow, focused on that post-war European scene, Sartre, de Beauvoir, Camus.
While others see its roots stretching way, way back, even to Socrates.
Yeah, there's that argument too. Stephen Crowell had a useful take on it. He suggested it's maybe less a system of philosophy and more an approach, a way of thinking that actually rejects rigid systems, more like a lens to view things through.
Okay, I like that. A lens. And when we look through that lens, what's the most fundamental idea we see?
Well, arguably, it's that phrase, existence precedes essence.
Right. That's the big one, especially for Sartre. Frederick Copleston pointed to that as the key unifying doctrine.
And Sartre himself, he described it as trying to draw out all the consequences of consistent atheism.
But it's important to note not all existentialists were atheists, right?
Absolutely crucial point. For someone like Kierkegaard, a profoundly religious thinker, existentialism wasn't about rejecting God. It was more about.
The human search for meaning in a world that doesn't just hand it to you.
Precisely. Asking what makes life good without expecting easy answers.
And there's even a little detail about the word existential itself.
Yeah, a small historical footnote. Kierkegaard might have borrowed the term existential from a Norwegian poet, Welhaven.
Fascinating. Okay, let's really dig into existence precedes essence. You called it the cornerstone.
It really is, especially in Sartre's version. Think about making something like a paper knife.
Okay.
Its essence, its design, its purpose exists in the mind before the actual knife exists, right?
Yeah.
It's conceived, then made.
Got it. Essence comes first for an object.
But for humans, Sartre flips it completely, radically. He says you're not born with a preset essence, a blueprint, a purpose.
So you just exist first.
You exist first. You're thrown into the world, as Heidegger might say. And only then, through your choices, through your actions.
You define yourself.
You define yourself. Your life, the way you live it, creates your essence. You're literally building your own values, your own meaning as you go.
Wow. That's huge. Because if there's no fixed purpose you're born with,
then the responsibility is entirely yours.
That's the radical implication you mentioned earlier. Total responsibility for who you become.
Exactly. And that's a major break from a lot of traditional Western thought, like Aristotle or Aquinas,
mm-hmm.
where humanness or treeness was seen as an inherent essence-defining purpose.
Existentialists say, nope, not for us humans.
Pretty much. And while Sartre nailed it with that phrase, you see similar ideas bubbling up elsewhere.
Like in Heidegger. Or Kierkegaard's focus on inwardness.
Mm-hmm. That subjective internal experience of being.
This self-definition idea, it also connects to Sartre's concept of bad faith, right?
Yes, absolutely. Bad faith is basically lying to yourself about your freedom. It's inauthentic.
How so?
It's like wishing you were brave but never acting bravely. Or blaming your upbringing or your genes for your actions, saying, I couldn't help it.
Ah, so you're denying your power to choose differently.
Precisely. Sartre would say if you consistently act cruelly, then you are a cruel person by definition of those acts. You can't blame human nature. You chose it.
But the flip side of that is quite liberating, isn't it? That quote.
Man, first of all, exists, encounters himself, surges up in the world, and defines himself afterwards.
Yeah. The positive spin is huge. If you're not predefined, you can always choose to act differently.
You can change. You can become something new. It's never too late to redefine your essence through new actions.
That's the therapeutic potential, I guess.
Definitely. Jonathan Weber's idea about essence being teleological, having a purpose, helps too.
How does that work?
Well, a house has a purpose, a telos, built into its design. We don't. We choose our own telos, our own purpose.
Unlike the house.
Right. Now, Sartre stressed this radical, almost moment-to-moment freedom. Simone de Beauvoir added a layer.
Oh, yeah. Sedimentation.
Exactly. Our past choices build up, creating a kind of inertia. So while change is always possible, it often happens more slowly because we carry that weight of past decisions.
That feels very true to experience. It's not always easy to just flip a switch.
No, it isn't. And it's worth remembering Heidegger's critique here.
Right. He thought Sartre hadn't gone deep enough.
He felt just reversing the old formula existence before essence instead of essence before existence was still stuck in the same metaphysical game.
Still playing with the same concepts, just in a different order.
Kind of. Heidegger wanted to question the very nature of being itself, something he felt Sartre overlooked.
Okay. So if we're creating our own meaning, what happens when that feels impossible? When the world just seems meaningless?
Ah, well, that brings us squarely to the absurd.
The idea that there's no built-in meaning out there in the universe.
Exactly. The world itself is indifferent. It doesn't operate according to our ideas of fairness or purpose.
Which clashes hard with how we often want the world to be, right? We look for reasons, for justice.
Mm-hmm. But existentialism, particularly Camus's version, says the universe doesn't offer that. The absurd is that clash, that gap between our longing for meaning and the silent, indifferent world.
And you said random, tragic events can really force this confrontation.
Absolutely. When something terrible happens for no discernible reason, it can shatter illusions of a meaningful order and throw you face to face with the absurd.
This is where it gets really interesting. The idea that bad things don't just happen to bad people. To the world, there's no such thing.
Right. It's a tough concept.
Yeah.
Albert Camus, who really owned this idea of the absurd, put it starkly in The Myth of Sisyphus.
That's the essay with the famous line about suicide.
There is only one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. Because if life is fundamentally meaningless, why go on?
That's heavy. What was his answer?
His answer was rebellion, defiance. He uses the myth of Sisyphus, doomed to push a rock uphill forever, only to watch it roll down again.
Seems like the ultimate futile task.
It is. But Camus says one must imagine Sisyphus happy. Why? Because Sisyphus accepts the absurdity, scorns his fate, and finds meaning in the struggle itself.
So the hero is the one who lives fully, embraces the struggle, even knowing it's ultimately pointless.
Exactly. Living without appeal, facing the absurd, without succumbing to despair or suicide. That's the absurdist triumph.
You see this theme everywhere in literature and art, don't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Kierkegaard, Beckett, Kafka, Dostoevsky, Ionesco, Camus himself, Heller's Sketch 22. It's a powerful recurring motif.
Okay, moving on, let's talk about facticity.
Right. Facticity? Mm-hmm. Sartre called it the in itself. Basically, it's the collection of brute facts about your existence that you didn't choose.
Like my past, my body, where I was born.
Exactly. Your history, your physical limitations, your social context, the values you were raised with, Heidegger called it being thrown into the world.
So authenticity means acknowledging this stuff, not denying it.
Yes. Pretending your past didn't happen or that your circumstances have no influence, that's inauthentic.
But it's a paradox, you said earlier. It limits you, but also enables freedom.
Precisely. You didn't choose your birthplace. That's a limitation.
Yeah.
But your values, your choices, they often arise in response to those very facts. Your facticity provides the context, the material for your freedom to work on.
Can you give an example?
Think about the two criminals you mentioned. One uses his past as an excuse, blames his facticity, and stays stuck, denying his freedom.
Right.
The other acknowledges the same difficult past, the same facticity, but chooses to define himself differently now, taking responsibility. He uses his freedom in relation to his facticity.
So the meaning or value of your facticity isn't fixed. You choose it.
You choose how you relate to it, yes. And this ties right into angst.
How so?
Well, angst arises partly from the tension between your radical freedom and these unchosen limitations, your facticity, but also from the terrifying realization that there's no external facticity, no human nature to blame if things go wrong. It's all on you.
Which leads perfectly into authenticity.
Exactly. Authenticity is living in sync with that freedom. It's about creating yourself, like we said, acting as you, the choosing individual.
Not just as a product of your genes or your upbringing.
Right, or not just playing a role. An authentic act flows from your conscious choice, reflects your actual values, and you take full responsibility for it.
And the opposite is inauthenticity.
Which is denying that freedom, pretending choices are random, maybe blaming fate or determinism.
Or that mimicry thing, just doing what one is supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Just conforming to expectations without genuine choice. Sartre's famous example is the waiter in the cafe.
Ah, the waiter in Bad Faith.
Yes. He plays the role of waiter too perfectly. His movements are a little too precise, his concern a little too solicitous. He's become absorbed in the performance.
He's acting the part, not being a person who happens to be a waiter.
Exactly. He's objectified himself, reduced his being to the function, denying his own fluid consciousness and freedom. That's bad faith.
Okay. Now, what about the other and the look? Sounds a bit mysterious.
It's about how we experience other people. The other is simply encountering another free consciousness, another subject, in the world.
Which confirms the world isn't just my experience.
Right. It establishes intersubjectivity, our shared reality, and objectivity, the world existing independently of me.
And the look or the gaze.
That's the experience of being seen by that other. And crucially, for Sartre, it often feels like a limitation. It turns you into an object in their world.
Ah, like you lose your subjective freedom for a moment.
Sort of. Sartre's classic example is the man peeping through a keyhole.
Right, I remember this. He's totally absorbed.
Lost in his own world, his own consciousness. Then he hears a floorboard creak behind him.
And instantly feels...
shame. He becomes aware of himself as seen. As an object for the other, a peeping Tom. That sudden self-consciousness, that objectification, is the look.
And for Sartre, that shame proves other minds exist.
Yes, and it shows how being seen by others becomes part of your own facticity, part of the given reality you have to deal with.
And the really unnerving part is, it doesn't even need someone actually looking.
Exactly. It's your awareness that you could be seen, your awareness of yourself as a potential object in another's world. That's enough to trigger the feeling.
Wow, okay. That leads us nicely into angst and dread.
Mm-hmm. A very common theme. It's generally that negative feeling, that anxiety that comes from recognizing your own freedom and total responsibility.
The cliff edge example captures it well, doesn't it?
Perfectly. You're not just afraid of accidentally falling. You feel a deeper dread, the dread of the possibility that you could choose to throw yourself off.
That feeling of nothing's stopping me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're experiencing your own terrifying freedom, the lack of external constraints on your will.
And angst is different from fear because fear has an object.
Right. You fear the snake, the fall, the attacker. Angst is often described as being before nothing. There's no specific thing to remove or avoid to make the angst go away.
Because the source is internal. It's your freedom.
Yes. The nothing refers to that lack of external grounding, the abyss of freedom, and the insecurity about the consequences of your choices for which you are solely responsible.
And finally, in this cluster of concepts, despair. How is existential despair different from just feeling hopeless?
It's more specific. Existential despair is a loss of hope that happens when a core part of your identity, something that defines you, breaks down.
Like the singer losing their voice example.
Exactly. If being a singer was fundamental to their sense of self, losing that ability triggers despair because their very being feels shattered.
And this is universal because our identities are built on things that can crumble.
Precisely. Our identities are contingent. They depend on qualities, roles, relationships that aren't permanent. And since there's no fixed human essence underneath it all to guarantee stability,
we're always potentially vulnerable to this kind of despair.
Yes. It's seen as part of the human condition. Mm-hmm. Kierkegaard really drove this home. He argued that unhappiness doesn't ultimately stem from external circumstances you can't control.
It's more internal.
Mm-hmm. And he made that great distinction. Relating hopefully to the possibility of good is hope, but relating expectantly to the possibility of evil, that's fear.
Okay, so existentialism defines itself partly by what it opposes, like positivism and rationalism.
Definitely. Existentialists tend to push back against the idea that humans are primarily rational beings, or that reason alone can solve life's deepest problems.
They think decisions are more about subjective meaning, what feels important to the individual.
Yes. Reason is a tool, a useful one, but it has limits when you're dealing with questions of purpose, value, death, freedom. It can't give you the ultimate answers.
Sartre even saw relying too much on rationality as a kind of
bad faith.
Yeah.
He felt it was an attempt to impose a neat, logical structure onto a world that's fundamentally messy, irrational, random.
And doing that hinders freedom, makes you conform.
It can, yeah. By trying to suppress the anxiety and dread that come with freedom, you might just end up accepting the status quo, conforming to the look of the other, rather than choosing authentically.
What about religion? How does existentialism interact with, say, the Bible?
Well, an existentialist reading wouldn't focus on historical accuracy or literal doctrine so much.
What then?
It would see the Bible as a record of human encounters with the divine or with ultimate questions. The stories and commandments aren't just external rules. They demand an internal response. They speak to you from the inside.
Ah, like Kierkegaard's point about the teacher versus the learner.
Exactly. Who has the more difficult task?
Yeah.
The teacher who lectures on earnest things a meteor's distance from everyday life, or the learner who should put it to use?
It's about internalizing it, living it, not just knowing it.
Precisely. And this led to movements like demythologization in theology,
where thinkers tried to strip away the mythical elements of scripture
to get at the underlying existential truths, the core messages about human existence, faith, doubt, and commitment, making them relevant for modern life. Bultmann was key here.
Now let's tackle a common confusion. Existentialism versus nihilism. People mix them up, right?
All the time. And it's understandable because both grapple with the potential meaninglessness of life, the anguish that can cause. Nietzsche is a key figure for both, actually.
But they're not the same.
Definitely not. If we connect this to the bigger picture, many assume existentialism leads straight to nihilism, but that's a crucial distinction.
How would you define the difference?
Nihilism essentially concludes life is meaningless, so nothing matters. Values are baseless. Existentialism starts from a similar place, the lack of inherent objective meaning, but it doesn't stop there.
It emphasizes the response.
Yes. The emphasis is on persisting through the absurdity. Remember Camus again. One must imagine Sisyphus happy. It's about creating meaning and value through your choices and commitments, even in a meaningless universe.
So it's not nothing matters. It's up to you to make things matter.
That's a great way to put it. Existentialists rarely dismiss morality entirely. Kierkegaard found it in faith. Sartre, despite not finishing it, planned a whole work on ethics. It's about subjective value creation, not the denial of all value.
Okay, that's a vital distinction. Let's maybe take a quick look back at the history. Where did these ideas come from?
Well, you can trace precursors way back. Mm-hmm. Some see hints in religious thinkers like Pascal. William Barrett pointed to him and Kierkegaard.
And Jean Wall saw echoes even in Shakespeare. Hamlet's to be or not to be.
Yeah, that questioning of existence itself. And interestingly, you find similar themes outside Europe, like in the work of the Iranian philosopher Mulla Sadra.
But the real foundations are usually considered 19th century.
Right. Kierkegaard and Nietzsche are the big two, even though neither use the label existentialist.
What set them apart?
They shifted focus dramatically towards subjective experience, how life feels from the inside, rather than objective, scientific truth being the be-all and end-all.
And they both stressed free will, how choices define us.
Absolutely. Think of Kierkegaard's Night of Faith, making that radical leap.
Or Nietzsche's Übermensch, creating values after the death of God.
Both are models of individuals defining their own existence, taking responsibility for meaning in a world that doesn't provide it ready-made.
And Dostoevsky in literature.
Hugely important. Notes from Underground is almost a manifesto of alienation and existential angst. Sartre loved The Brothers Karamazov for its portrayal of crisis.
Even Crime and Punishment deals with these themes. Guilt, freedom.
Profoundly. Even as Raskolnikov moves towards a Christian resolution, his journey is steeped in existential struggle.
Then moving into the early 20th century,
you get figures in Spain like Unamuno, with his focus on the flesh and bone individual and the tragic sense of life.
And Ortega y Gasset's idea, I am myself and my circumstances.
Right, emphasizing that existence is always situated.
Yeah.
Then there's Martin Buber's I and Thou, exploring authentic relationships.
Russian thinkers like Shestov and Berdyaev focusing on freedom.
Gabriel Marcel, who coined the term, but had his own distinct, often faith-based philosophy. Carl Jaspers talking about existence philosophy and self-becoming.
And of course, Heidegger's Being and Time.
A massive influence, even if his relationship with existentialism as a label is complex. He laid so much groundwork analyzing Dasein, human existence.
So what does this all mean for the public? It seems like after World War II, things really took off.
Oh, big time. The post-war era is where existentialism exploded into public consciousness.
Primarily through Sartre and Camus.
Yes, they became international celebrities, public intellectuals in a way that's hard to imagine now.
Sartre had already written Nausea and Being and Nothingness.
Dense works, yes. But it was the atmosphere after the liberation of Paris, 1945 onwards, that really propelled him and his Cercle Camus de Beauvoir into the spotlight.
And that 1945 lecture, Existentialism is a Humanism, was the spark.
It was a cultural phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Packed hall, people feigning the first media craze of the post-war era, as it's been called.
Wow. And we absolutely have to highlight Simone de Beauvoir's role here.
Crucial. The Second Sex, The Ethics of Ambiguity, she brilliantly fused existentialist ideas about freedom and self-creation with feminist analysis. Groundbreaking stuff.
Truly. And Camus, meanwhile, was popular but kept his distance from the label.
Yeah, preferring absurdism. The myth of Sisyphus remains incredibly powerful and accessible. That image of finding meaning in the struggle.
It really resonates. Other figures from that time.
Paul Tillich applied these ideas in theology. Maurice Merleau-Ponty brought in phenomenology in a major way. Colin Wilson tried to popularize it in English, though maybe with mixed results academically.
So beyond philosophy itself, where has existentialism left its mark? Seems like everywhere.
It's had a massive cultural impact, really pervasive.
In film, for instance. Kubrick's Paths of Glory.
Great example. Shows the absurdity of war, individual ethics under extreme pressure. Or Welles' adaptation of Kafka's The Trial. Pure absurdist nightmare.
Even things like anime, Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Deeply influenced by Sartre and Kierkegaard. Themes of angst, responsibility, the burden of consciousness. It's amazing how these ideas travel.
And directors like Bergman, Kurosawa, Nolan.
Absolutely. Think of Kurosawa's Red Beard, where the young doctor confronts suffering and finds a new purpose. Or Charlie Kaufman's films like Synecdoche, New York. Almost pure existential exploration.
Literature, too, obviously, besides the main philosophers.
Celine's Journey to the End of the Night was a huge early influence. Kafka, Rilke, T.S. Eliot, Hesse, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man.
Even H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, that cosmic horror. Humanity's insignificance in a vast, uncaring universe. It taps into similar existential anxieties about lack of control.
And theater. Sartre's No Exit.
With that killer line, hell is other people. Which, by the way, is often misinterpreted. It's about being trapped by the judgments, the look of others.
Oh, right. And Beckett's Waiting for Godot.
The absolute classic of absurdist theater. Waiting, questioning, filling time in the face of meaninglessness.
Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead too.
Brilliant. Takes minor characters from Hamlet and throws their powerlessness, their confusion about the plot they're trapped in, into sharp relief.
And Inouye's Antigone during the Nazi occupation, choosing death over a compromised life.
A powerful act of defiance, drawing clear parallels to the resistance. Art becomes a form of existential commitment.
What about activism?
Black existentialism is a really important area. Thinkers like Fanon, Angela Davis, Cornel West.
Exploring the specific experiences of Black people facing absurdity, racism, the fight for self-definition against oppression.
Exactly. Applying existentialist tools to understand and combat unique forms of dehumanization and struggle for freedom.
So this brings up that question for many of us. How can this philosophy, which sounds so intense, actually help in everyday life? The therapy connection seems key.
It really is. Existential psychology became a major field. Figures like Otto Rank, Binswanger, Viktor Frankl, and his logotherapy.
Which focuses on finding meaning.
Yes. And in the U.S., Rolla May and Irvin Yalom were hugely influential.
So how does it work in therapy?
Well, therapists use these ideas to help people understand anxiety, not as something to just get rid of, but as a signal.
A signal of what?
A signal of their awareness of freedom and responsibility. The goal isn't to eliminate anxiety, but to harness it.
Use it as motivation.
Exactly. Use it constructively, as grounds for making conscious choices, for change, for living more authentically and realizing your potential.
And this connects to terror management theory.
Mm-hmm. Which looks at how our deep, often unconscious, awareness of death shapes our behavior, our values, our cultures. Confronting mortality is central.
Of course, like any major philosophy, existentialism has faced criticism.
Oh, absolutely. Walter Kaufmann, who actually did a lot to introduce existentialists to English readers, still criticized their methods sometimes, their contempt for reason.
And the logical positivists had issues.
Yeah, philosophers like Carnap argue they misused language, particularly the verb to be, making grand claims about being that were logically meaningless to them.
Colin Wilson felt they got stuck.
He thought they created their own problems, ended up walking in circles, perhaps being a bit too pessimistic or navel-gazing.
And Sartre specifically drew fire.
Quite a bit. Accusations of contradicting himself, making metaphysical claims while saying he avoided metaphysics.
Herbert Marcuse had a critique.
Yes, he argued, being and nothingness projected anxiety onto existence itself, and in doing so, it mirrored the very oppressive ideologies it aimed to fight.
And Heidegger's famous put-down.
His distancing in the letter on humanism, saying Sartre's reversal existence precedes essence, was still just playing the same old metaphysical game. The reversal of a metaphysical statement remains a metaphysical statement.
Ouch. Still quite a legacy.
Undeniably.
So this deep dive, it really shows existentialism isn't one simple thing. It's this incredibly rich, diverse family of ideas.
From that radical focus on freedom and responsibility.
Deep insights about being authentic, facing the absurd, dealing with other people.
It really challenges us to look squarely at what it means to be human without easy answers.
It feels like it's not about waiting for meaning to be given to you.
Not at all. It's about realizing the power and the burden of having to create it yourself.
Yeah.
Facing that void, that lack of pre-given purpose, and choosing to build something anyway.
So maybe the final thought for you, the listener, is this. If your existence truly comes before your essence, what new essence will you choose to create for yourself starting today? Knowing the full weight, but also the incredible wonder of that choice.